Thank you. Thank you very much for the introduction. And I would like to thank the organizers for giving this wonderful opportunity to be here and to present our recent work on domain walls. This is not a talk about qubits. Collaborators, Dr. Chiba is working in my group as a postdoc. Mr. Yamanouchi is a PhD student. Tomasz Dietl is a professor at Polish Academy of Sciences, and Dr. Matsukura is a research associate in my group. And the work is supported by the Minister of Education here. All right, so this is the layout of my talk. I would like to describe to you the background, and then I would briefly review our previous work on domain wall switching. And then I would like to show you our recent results on the domain wall velocity as well as domain wall resistance in the material we are working on, and would like to summarize my talk. So the material that we are working on is ferromagnetic 3-5 semiconductors, which we synthesized back in 1989 when I was working at the IBM Yorktown Research together with Hiro Munekata and actually Steve von Molnar back in the audience. At that time, this indium arsenide-based ferromagnetic semiconductor was not ferromagnetic yet, but a few years later we found that we can make it ferromagnetic. So a non-magnetic semiconductor like indium arsenide, or in this case, gallium arsenide, can be made ferromagnetic by alloying these materials with manganese. So manganese will provide you holes that stabilize ferromagnetism as well as localized spins. So this is an example of our material. This is magnetic field versus magnetization. And you get hysteresis. This is a blow-up view of the region close to the origin, and you see that you have a ferromagnetic ordering in the system, and in this particular case, you get hysteresis when you apply magnetic field in plane because your easy axis is lying in the plane. Okay, and we know that the ferromagnetism is due to carrier-mediated or carrier-stabilized. So we can change carrier concentration by gating an FET structure, and we can turn on and off isothermally without changing the ambient temperature, the ferromagnetic phase transition. So this is the material we're working on. And the thing that I would like to tell you today about is the domain wall in this system. So, I assume that everybody already knows what the domain wall is, but basically, when you have a piece of iron, for example, it's usually not a magnet because it has magnetic domains in it, and this, the transition between these domains, the domain forms because of the competition of between exchange and magnetostatic energies. And this transition region at the interface of these two domains is called a domain wall. And the domain wall, in our case, the domain wall width is about 17 or 20 nanometers. So we are talking about the nanometer scale dimension here. And the domain wall width is determined by the stiffness, so that a domain wall tries to get, exchange interaction makes the domain wall, tries to make the domain wall as long as possible, whereas the cost of tilting your spin away from the easy axis tries to reduce the dimension of the domain wall. So the domain wall, actual domain wall width is a balance between these two terms, and it happens to be around 10-20 nanometers in our case. Okay, so why are we interested in domain walls, especially in gallium manganese arsenide, or 3-5. And the physics point of view, this domain wall addresses a physics of non-trivial interaction between carrier spins and local spin texture and its consequences. So what we are going to do is to try to flow current through this domain wall and see what are the consequences are. And technology, from the technology point of view, we are all interested in electrical manipulation of magnetization. And we will hear more about this part from Stuart Parkin's talk this afternoon. And the reason for this is that smaller magnets get harder to reverse. And this is because when you have a bar magnet, it magnetizes in this way or the other way around. It never magnetizes in this direction. And this is because this is magnetostatically, it has a magnetostatically higher energy. But in order to switch this left-pointing magnetization to right-pointing magnetization in, let's say, in a magnetic memories, you have to go through this situation. And in order to do this by magnetic field, this switching field, the field that requires to put your magnetization in this direction, is roughly proportional to your magnetization and thickness divided by the width. The thickness of this magnetic element is determined by many other reasons, and it's already very thin. So you cannot play too much with this thickness here. So when you try to integrate more bits in a certain area, you have to reduce the element, and you will have to end up reducing your width, which is this one. And by reducing width, your switching field, the magnetic field that requires to switch the magnetic element, gets higher and higher. So this is the problem inherent in magnetic recording. So people in magnetic recording industry is fighting against this non-scalability but this can be overcome by electrically manipulating magnetization. For example, one way of doing this is to flow current through a domain wall. And this current is spin polarized because it's a current inside a ferromagnet. And this spin polarized current will exert torque and force to this domain wall and displace this domain wall. And which means that you can actually realize the magnetization reversal by current. And this is scalable because the domain wall displacement requires a certain current density. By reducing the dimension of your element, it means that the required current reduces. So by making the structure smaller and smaller, you have to supply only smaller and smaller current. The single domain wall motion has only been recently seen in ferromagnetic semiconductors and metals, and that's the thing that I'm going to talk about under the absence of magnetic field. And gallium manganese arsenide. Why gallium manganese arsenide? Well, because it has small. It gives you a very different parameter set from an ordinary ferromagnet. It has very small magnetization. We have 5%, roughly 5% manganese in our system, which gives you about 1/100 of magnetization compared to metal counterparts. And it gives you a reasonably high spin polarization in the material. And actually, I will come back to this later on, but the PD Zener type well, model description applies to this. So we can actually use this PD Zeno model to calculate many properties of the material. So we have many control and understanding over the material properties. So it will be very interesting to see how this domain wall motion in this gallium manganese arsenide material. Okay, so the first thing we did was we wanted to see if we can switch domain wall position back and forth by spin polarized current in the gallium manganese arsenide structure. So the structure we first prepared, it looked like this. Here we have a channel layer of gallium manganese arsenide, which is 25 nanometers thick. The buffer layer structure here below it allows us to introduce tensile strain in gallium manganese arsenide layer. Indium gallium arsenide is designed to have larger lattice constant than gallium manganese arsenide grown on top of it. And this tensile strain makes easy access perpendicular to the plane, which actually makes your measurement easier. And we utilize this perpendicular easy access to probe our magnetization using Hall effect as well as by magneto-optical current microscopy. The structure we utilized in our first experiment is a double step structure. These two steps serve two purposes. One, it gives us in-plane patterning of coercivity. And this is because of the slight non-uniformity we have in gallium manganese arsenide film. So by removing some part of the top layer, we can actually reduce the coercivity. So removing 3 nanometers gives you a reduction of, let's say, 1.5 millitesla of your coercivity. And reducing further gives you further reduction. And this will allow you to prepare a domain wall at this point here. By applying magnetic field, and saturating the three regions, and then applying a negative magnetic field, this part reverses first because it has the smallest coercivity, and then this part reverses because it has a medium coercivity. And if we remove the magnetic field at that point, we end up having a domain wall at this point here. So that's how we initialize our configuration. It also serves as a domain wall confinement potential because domain wall energy is proportional to the area of the domain wall. So this is what we have found. We have three pairs of Hall probes, and this Hall probes allows us to measure the direction of magnetization because the Hall resistance is proportional to the magnetization because it is dominated by the anomalous Hall effect. So this region 1, you see that it's always positive, and this region 3, you see it's always negative. But this is our initial condition showing that region 2, we have our magnetization pointing downwards. And at this point of 30 seconds, we pulse the structure in this direction with a current pulse of about 10 to the 5 amps per square centimeter for 100 milliseconds. And we see that our sign of region 2 changes from negative to positive, showing that our domain wall is now at the other end of the structure. And by just reversing the current direction, we can put it back almost to its original position, and we can keep it switching this position back and forth at as many times as you want. And we also visualize the domain wall motion by using magneto-optical Kerr effect. We first prepare the domain wall at this point, and by passing a current pulse through through the structure, we get a domain wall at this point here, and then reversing the current pulse, we get the domain wall back to its original position. So that's fine. And the current density required is 10 to 5 amps per square centimeter. A very similar experiments have been done in metallic structures. So this is the case of metallic systems. A group at Osaka University led by Teruo Ono has shown that using 10 nanometer thick permalloy wire structure, they can move back and forth the domain wall. The structure they used here is this is shown here. This is your magnetic wire, 10 nanometer thick, 240 nanometer wide. And by applying magnetic field in this direction, your domain wall is nucleated at this pad and gets down to this bent structure here. And it cannot go this way because your magnetic field is pointing up. And then you remove the magnetic field and apply a current pulse and search for the place of the domain wall by magnetic force microscopy. From these experiments, they have found that the domain wall velocity is a function of current density, and the current density required to see this effect is of the order of 10 to 8 amps per square centimeter, or 10 to 12 amps per square meter. This is very high, actually. This is about the limit of current pulse that a metal system can take under zero magnetic field. Very similar experiment has been done in UK and in Germany as well. And they all report having rather similar dimensions. They all report that the current density required to see this effect is of the order of 10 to 8 amps per square centimeter. And as you can see from this slide, well, first of all, this will give you an appreciable heating. And from this slide, you can see that it's very difficult, actually, to discuss about the velocity versus current density characteristics, which is essential to understand the mechanism behind the effect that we're seeing. So we wanted to go ahead and see how, in our system, this domain wall velocity as a function of current density looks like. So for this purpose, we have prepared this device. Now we have only one step because we want to prepare a domain wall at this point and then see how it propagates in this direction. So again, we have gallium manganese arsenide, this time 30 nanometers. The buffer structure is there in order to introduce tensile strain in our magnetic layer, which makes our easy access perpendicular to the plane. And the dimension is shown here. The wire, the gallium manganese arsenide wire, is rather wide, 5 micron. The region of interest here is 60 micron. Okay, so this is just a measurement sequence. We prepare initial configuration where the domain wall is sitting at the edge of this step, and we apply current pulse in this direction, and the domain wall moves in the opposite to the current direction, and we just subtract this image from the original initial condition image, just to enhance the contrast, so the area swept by the domain wall is seen by the change in the contrast. So this is what we have found. At 100 Kelvin ambient temperature, at about 5 times 10 to 5 amps per square centimeter, we see that our domain wall moves as we increase the pulse width. And the pulse width and the distance is a linear function from which we can determine the velocity of our domain wall. Okay, this wedged-shaped structure is there because we believe there are two reasons for this. One is that magnetic field generated by current can give us some skewed domain wall configuration. At the same time, the domain will the whole voltage across the domain will has opposite sign, so it will produce this type of current flow, which also gives us the source of this knife-edged domain wall configuration. Okay, we also see temperature increase, slight temperature increase of about 2 to, let's say, 16 Kelvin. So we had to correct this temperature, and we used the sample resistance as a thermometer. And at very low current density, 10 to 3 amps per square centimeter, we first measure the temperature, resistance of the device as a function of temperature, and use this to measure the actual temperature of the device. And fortunately, the heat capacity of our device is small enough so that the pulse width that we're using, the temperature is almost constant, and the temperature rise is was a function of the current density that we're using. So at any ambient temperature we are looking at, from 90 Kelvin to 100 some Kelvin, we can collapse the temperature increase to one single curve. So the current density, for a given current density, the temperature rise is a fixed value, as you can see from this this slide, this curve. So we use this curve to correct our temperature, and we believe that our scheme is correct because at ambient temperature of 100 Kelvin and this 10 to 6 amps per square centimeter for one 10 to 6 amps per square centimeter, which from this curve we reach 112 Kelvin, which is the TC, transition temperature of our material, and we do see multi-domain structure indicating that we indeed went over the transition temperature of our material. So we first measured for a given ambient temperature velocity as a function of current density. But remember that each point we have different temperature, or we have different sample temperatures. So we generated this current density, temperature, and velocity curve using the corrected temperature. And we cut from this surface of this data a constant temperature, velocity versus current density curve at a constant temperature. And that's how we obtained this curve, this velocity as a function of current density with under various temperatures. This waviness is due to the fitting procedure, so it's a measurement artifact. So we see some threshold current density, and the velocity increases as you increase the current density. So we wanted to understand what we can learn from this curve. First of all, we can the mechanism behind it. We can easily disregard the effect of Oersted field, because keeping our current density in or current direction in this way, and we can prepare two different magnetization configuration for the initial condition. And this gives exactly the same result. So except for the direction of the wedge shape that I have shown you before. So we can easily disregard this Oersted field. We can also rule out the hydromagnetic domain wall drag, which has been proposed by many authors shown here, and that's because of first of all, hydromagnetic domain wall drag is that because we have different polarity in terms of a hole voltage across the domain wall, we end up having a circulating current at the domain wall, and we do not say that this effect is not there. But it's not the one that is dominating, because the positive Hall coefficient that we have in our system should give should result in domain wall propagation along the current, not the opposite to the current direction, which we are seeing. So we can rule out this mechanism not responsible for what we are seeing. We believe that we can explain our results due to adiabatic spin transfer. Adiabatic means that at each point of space, electron spin is pointing the same direction as manganese spins. At least the direction of this of the domain wall motion can be explained in the following way. We have current in this direction, so electrons are moving from one side, from this side to left side to right hand side, and electrons through this motion, electron linear motion, it changes the sign of spin from down to up, and it has to conserve angular momentum, or our system has to conserve angular momentum. And at least some part of this electron, the angular momentum change in the electron system will transfer to manganese system. And since electrons will go from up, down to up, some of our manganese has to go from up to down, which means that it the domain wall propagates in the direction of electron flow if our electrons are pointing the same direction as manganese spins. And we believe that this is the case based on the PD Zener model we use for describing many properties that we see in our material. Basically, this PD Zener model is that here you have a valence band and conduction band of your semiconductor system, and you introduce manganese in our case. D state in the majority spin state and D state, empty D state in minority spin state. And at the same time, because manganese are an acceptor, we will introduce also some holes in the system. And because of the PD interaction, this D state pushes the valence band up and the opposite valence band down. And we have redistribution of holes or electrons which stabilizes our ferromagnetism. And if you look at the Fermi surface, the majority of electrons that participate in transport have the same spin orientation or spin direction with respect to the manganese system. So this explains the direction of the domain wall motion. We wanted to go further and do some quantitative comparison between theory and our experiment. And very fortunately, we do have two theories, at least on this domain wall motion. Very unfortunately, these two theories don't agree each other. First of all, Gen Tatara, who is in the audience, showed, and Kono showed, that there should be a square root dependence. This is our velocity, this is our current density, and there's a threshold current density, and this proportionality factor is determined by the spin transfer effect. And the other one proposed by Barnes and Maekawa have almost the same, very similar dependence. A velocity is a function of current density minus threshold current density, which is related to defect finite. The difference between the two is not only the functional form, but the origin of this critical current density that you have to overcome in order to see this effect. Tatar and Kono says that this is intrinsic. So you have an intrinsic current density. But Barnes and Maekawa says, no, there's no intrinsic current density, critical current density, and it's all related to pinning. Another thing is that these two are related to spin transfer mechanism that I just described, but Tatara and Kono said there is another region where you have to include momentum transfer effect. I'll come back to this later on. Okay, so experimentally, we can try to fit our data in two ways. One with square root dependence, which shows in this dashed line. We choose this linear part here and fitted this square root dependence, and we can determine the threshold current density. We also, it's easier for linear dependence with threshold current density. It shows this way, and we can also determine the slope as well as the threshold current density. In addition, we can also calculate these coefficients from the knowledge or experimentally determined magnetization. We can also calculate the spin polarization from the PD Zener model that I just described. We also can calculate the block wall width, which is 17 nanometers. And we can also calculate this anisotropy constant K, which is, in our case, at the temperature close to transition temperature, is due to stray field energy density. So we can actually calculate this A, which is the same for the two models. We can actually calculate this critical current density based on Tatara-Kono theory. So what we did was, this is our experimental fit. We remember that we are using two types of fit. This is our efficiency, the slope, and this is our current density, critical current density. Basically, it gives us a very similar critical current density. It doesn't depend too much on the functional form that we're using. And if we compare this with our calculation, which is this, and here is a SERI. So actually, our spin transfer rate is higher than the theoretical expected value. Remember that, we have many assumptions to calculate this value. For example, we have used a thermodynamic spin polarization, whereas you should use current spin polarization. So there are many uncertainties here, but the theory can account for, within the factor of two, what we are seeing, both theories. Here, we compare our results with intrinsic critical current density, and we found that the theory goes exactly on our experimental finding. Of course, this is given the uncertainties and assumptions that we made to calculate this. This is too good to be true, of course, but still it gives some credit to the theory given by Tatara and Kono. Okay, so if this is correct, then for metals, if we go back and calculate, put reasonable numbers for metals, the metal critical current density is of the order of 10 to the 9, 10 to the 10 amps per square centimeter. So this is experimentally inaccessible. But we still, or people have seen, domain wall motion in metal structures as well. So if this is indeed the case, there has to be other mechanisms to see these domain wall motion in metallic systems. I'll come back to this later on. Okay, there's some activities around here as well. Sub-threshold regime. In this scale, we cannot see it, so I will expand it, or I will rescale this vertical axis in a logarithmic fashion. And as you can see, we were seeing this part in the previous slide, but now we are focusing on the slow velocity part. And this slow velocity part has now a logarithmic function, or exponentially dependent on current density. Tatara has also put forward a thermally assisted domain wall motion under spin current, but this velocity is inversely proportional to temperature. But here, when temperature rises, the slope becomes steeper. So this cannot explain our results. So we took an experimentalist approach. We borrowed the functional form from a paper that studied domain wall creep under a magnetic field. This is magnetic field. So and replace this magnetic field by our current. This is just a working hypothesis. And borrowed the functional form. We used this new mu is equal to minus 1/2. It describes our experimental finding very well, which means that our creep is two-dimensional. And we determined A and B at each temperature using this functional form. And what we found was that A, the coefficient A, is proportional to Tc minus T, and coefficient B is Tc minus T squared. We don't know why this A and B have this functional form, but it's rather reasonable considering that we are working very close to transition temperature. So using these A and B, we can generate this type of curve. And as you can see, all these different curves can collapse onto the same curves that have the same slope. So it seems to indicate that we are seeing current-assisted domain wall creep. Remember that this is not the magnetic field effect, because we can rule out the magnetic field effect by changing the initial configuration. So this seemed to, on the other hand, this seemed to indicate, because we are using current in the place of magnetic field, it seems to suggest the field-like term. So the spin polarized current might be acting on spins like field rather than exerting torque on them. And there are many suggestions starting from Berger in 1984. We have theory papers suggesting that there might be a field-like term, and there are experimental papers saying that there might be also that there is a field-like term. Okay, all right. Let me just go over very quickly the rest of my talk, which I would like to, well, because it is related to, especially Tatara and Kono says this field-like term is related to the domain wall resistance. We measure the domain wall resistance. I don't have enough time to go over it, so I just flash you. This is the current. Flash the rest of the slide. This is, we're talking about current exerted, well, domain wall motion here. So we wanted to know what the domain wall does on the current. Or on carrier transport. This has already been addressed, and people, including David Archon, found that the domain wall resistance, actually in this case, is negative in gallium-manganese arsenide. But in our case, we first used a series of device structures, which has the same width to length ratio. This is because we patterned the structure in such a way that we can have 10 domain walls at the initial condition. And remember that across the domain wall we have opposite sign of Hall voltage. So our current goes zigzag in this system, and it gives you an extra resistance. So we have to remove this extra part of resistance in order to address the intrinsic part of the domain wall resistance. And in order to do so, we prepared these four samples. And here we kept this ratio constant so that our zigzag part resistance is the same, but the domain wall area is different. Areas are different in these four samples. So basically what we did was we plotted domain 1 resistance as a function of 1 over area, and we found that our zigzag floor is here, and the additional domain wall resistance increases as you reduce the domain wall area. So, well, and we have also calculated the AMR contribution, anisotropic magnetic resistance contribution, which is small. So we believe that this, we are now seeing an intrinsic domain wall resistance, which is of the order of 0.5 ohms, ohm micrometer square, which is positive, and this can be explained reasonably well by Levy and Zhang Seri. So, and if you assume that this domain wall resistance is correct, from Tatara Kono formula, we get a velocity of 250 meters per second at 10 to 6 amperes square centimeter, which cannot be, which is not, which is not in agreement with our experiment. So, in summary, I have shown you that domain wall velocity, we have determined domain wall velocity as a function of current density and temperature in gallium manganese arsenide structures. We showed that A, spin transfer coefficient and critical current density can be explained by existing theory. Below JC, we have shown that domain wall creep is induced by current. And intrinsic domain wall resistance can be explained by Levy and Zhang theory of non-additive contribution. Thank you very much for your attention.
All right, so now we have time for questions. Yes.
Well, so basically the question is, have I annealed the sample to try to change the defect density? And the answer is not. During the processing, the sample is annealed, but we haven't done any systematic annealing experiment to see how it changes the domain wall velocity. And besides, it's very difficult to address the pinning. You know, it's very difficult to relate, at least, annealing with pinning sites. So it will not be a decisive experiment in any case. Adiabatic. So you're asking about the validity of adiabatic transfer. Okay. Let's say we are working on a diffusive scheme. The transport is diffusive, so we can calculate the diffusion time of our carriers through the domain wall and compare it with the precession of the spins inside the domain wall, because it has to precess around the local magnetization, and if you allow them to have enough time to precess around the local magnetization, then it will give you an adiabatic transport. And the ratio was around, I forgot, 20-30, if I remember correctly, this precession time versus the diffusion time. So it's spins have plenty of time precessing around the local magnetization. So we believe that it's very close to adiabatic transfer.
Oh.
Critical current, sorry. This? Yeah. Yes. Yes. Anisotropy is responsible for this. Basically, we are getting closer to transition temperature, and we're losing our magnetization. And this magnetization is directly determines this K. So, and at lower temperature, we are unable to access, because at lower temperature we have to drive this system at higher current density, and at higher current density, actually, the sample heats up. So there is only very limited range of, at least for the moment, there's a limited range of temperature that we can experimentally access.
Or
too big to explain our results. So for using the velocity comes out too big. So the resistance is too big. At least when we use the formula put forward by again Tatara, who is sitting right behind you. We believe it's a Bloch wall. It's energetically more favorable. Well, first of all, we have easy access perpendicular to the plane. So and the demagnetization field is less when you rotate it this way rather than this way. There's no way to directly see it, and we don't have any experimental confirmation for having Bloch wall, or the length scale of the domain wall either. We have calculated. As far as I understand, the theory applies both to nail wall and Bloch wall.
I have a question.
Yes.
You described this domain wall motion as a kind of not necessarily a depinning transition, but there was some creep involved. And I was wondering if it's possible to say monitor the resistance fluctuations and to look at the spectrum of the fluctuations and see if it is consistent with other types of systems for which you have that kind of depinning. I mean, is it possible to actually monitor the resistance fluctuations to use that as another way to monitor the domain wall?
It appears to me hard, but I have to think about it. Because it doesn't, the domain wall resistance itself is about constant wherever you put the domain wall. So even if it oscillates,
there's no signature in terms of the, and there's no back action of the domain wall on the electrons.
Well, that's a domain wall resistance, right?
Okay, so then if it's moving, you might expect to be able to observe that electrically.
Well, in principle, yes. But in order to determine the domain wall resistance, we had to go through an extensive procedure to exclude or to differentiate the resistance coming from other electromagnetic contributions, like zigzagging current and all those things. So the domain wall resistance is a very rather small part of the total resistance that we're seeing. Introduction of domain wall immediately changes the current path. which increases the resistance quite a bit. But that's not the intrinsic domain wall resistance. And if you're looking for intrinsic domain wall resistance, you know, in our case, we made four devices to extract this small number. So if I can come up with a good way of extracting this small number in one device in a very quick fashion, I might be able to address this address the dynamics of this from the domain wall resistance.
Michael?
Oh yeah, that's a very interesting and very good question, I suppose.
Can you repeat it?
What's the orbital part of angular momentum treated? Which means, basically, we are dealing with holes, and the holes especially, we believe we are dealing with heavy holes. So our total angular momentum is 3/2 rather than 1/2 for spins. And if you naively see this this figure here, this line comes from assuming that you only have 1/2 spin and 100% spin transfer from electron system to manganese system. So it's very tempting, at least, to say that we have more transfer than expected from Ceri, and that might be contribution from the orbital part. So we are not counting electron as a 3/2 or holes as 3/2 spins. Here we are only counting 1/2. So we can actually, if 100% spin transfer occurs for whole system, we can actually make it 3 times higher, the theoretical line. But that has not been theoretically addressed. Spin orbits is not included in any of these theories. That's probably because our heat capacity is rather small, and it's a fortunate experimental. I don't know the reason why, but it can be different. But the temperature range that we're looking at is rather small, or limited at least. So that's probably the reason why we can use a single correction curve. It depends on what you mean by Berry phase effect. I have to learn more from you about this Berry phase effect. What's the signature that I have to look for in order to say, you know, here is a Berry phase effect? But at the moment, the samples are rather big, and actually I don't know where to look for. And right.
This transfer through the junction. Actually, I think this is a strong difference in the relaxation. It is partly following the magnetic field, but the size, what is the size of the domain wall as compared to the whole inner relaxation?
Well, it's very difficult actually to experimentally address the spin spin relaxation time in this case. But there are some weak localization measurement at low temperature at high field, from which we can sort of get an idea of spin relaxation time, which I forgot the number. But the thing is that the spin diffusion lengths, if we use this experimentally determined at low temperature, high magnetic field, the spin diffusion length comes about around 20 nanometers, about the same length, say, of the domain wall width.
That diffusion length means multiple scattering.
Yes. Yes. So in our case, the mean free pass is rather small, of the order of 1 nanometer. And our domain wall width is 17, 20 nanometers. So it's a diffusive transport, yes.
But the spin diffusion length that at this temperature, most of the scattering is phonons or what? Is most of the scattering in the lab, if you think? Most of the scattering probably completely erases the spin net.
The diffusion constant that we used is from the mobility using Einstein relationship. I assume that the spin memory quickly goes away. But at the same time, we do see a very high efficiency of transferring the spins to the manganese system. So it's not going somewhere else, but the spin that carried by the spin polarized current is efficiently, at least from this experiment, is transferred to the magnetic system.
Okay, not to beat this into the ground, but if I can understand this correctly, typical domain wall velocity was on the order of meters per second. So if your domain wall is 20 nanometers, then you have 20 nanosecond time, basically, for the whole spin to rotate. So even if it weren't in the right state, very quickly it would probably relax. There's a time scale over which maybe these variphases would not become relevant because of the coherence times not being very long.
Well, temperature, it's 100 Kelvin. So it's interesting to see if we can come up with a scheme that we can do this at low temperature, very low temperature. But at the moment, I have to think about it.
So K here is a transfer of anisotropy, right?
This is an anisotropy to, basically we have a block wall, this way. And this K is to move this spin in this direction, along the wire. And that's the hardest. That's relevant to this motion.
Okay. Well, we can continue these discussions maybe at lunch. Let's thank Hideo again.